Podcast that you're about to hear comes from a program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. These sessions have been facilitated by Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree in partnership with the Wakery RSL sub-branch. To explore further podcasts, visit thewaywewere.podbean.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening. Today is the 13th of August, 2021. Firstly, thank you very much, June, for agreeing to talk with me today.
You're welcome.
Can I get you to start off just by stating your full name and your date of birth, please?
Georgina June Hanley, 1912-1926. I'll be 95 in December, but I'm only 94 now.
How are you feeling? Feeling good?
Oh, good, yeah. I'm slowing down, but I expect to. I'm better than most, so you've got to be grateful.
Oh, you look fantastic.
Yeah, well, I work at it. Not a face or anything like that, but I work at I do exercises, and I belong to a lot of clubs, you know, so I'm very active. That keeps me going. Longevity's in my family on my mother's side, so except my mother, it wasn't. She died when I was born. But yeah, so that's it. Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit, June, about where you were born and a little bit about your upbringing?
I was born in Broken Hill. The doctor had never delivered twins before, so he must have got a little bit mixed up with afterbirths or something, because she hemorrhaged every now and again, or very often, for 6 weeks, and eventually they decided to operate and she died, on the table. So I had a grandmother who would look after us, and she dragged one of my mother's sisters. There were three of them. One of them, she got out of school. She was 13. She got permission so that she could help her look after the kids. And she was marvellous, right until the day she died, and she died at 102. And she was marvellous to me and my sister, all our lives.
What was your grandmother's name and what was your sister's name?
Mary Elizabeth, I think, but Mary, Molly, we called her. I called her Mum. Elsegood, E-L-S-E-G-O-O-D. And my aunt, she was Iris Elsegood.
And what was your sister's name?
Oh, Romaine. I better get it right. But we call her Roma. Romaine, R-O-M-A-Y-N-E. She was the eldest one. The Georgina comes from my father. He was George. And my sister was Romaine Minetta. And my mother's name was Minetta.
So those first few years were about...
that's a story in itself. My father lived with my grandmother and with us kids, When we were about 3 years old, he wanted to get married again. My grandmother didn't like the idea of that, so she just bundled us up and brought us down to Adelaide and kept us from our father for 30 years. He came down looking for us. So I've heard since, because I've since linked up with my father, but he could never find us. When I can remember we used to move a lot of times, and I suspect now that it was because whenever he got near to finding us, he moved on with us, because she said he was marrying it again, and we would probably, have to take second place in the family, or also be as we got older, do all the work and look after all the new kids. She was worried about us. So, and besides that, he could have moved off somewhere too and taken us with him. So she just took us and her family, her two other daughters, down to Adelaide. Yeah, that was that.
Wow, that's quite complicated, really, isn't it?
Yes, but I was brought up to call her Mum, and that's what I did.
So can you tell me a little bit about those first years of maybe schooling?
Oh yeah, well, we went to school all over the place. Nailsworth, Brompton, by Enfield somewhere. Yeah, and Croydon, as I said, we moved around because I think, she didn't want us to find us. Yeah. I didn't feel that we missed out on anything. I didn't know him. You know, I didn't know that story either until I got older. And by that time, you know, I was quite happy. My grandmother didn't want, because he was getting married again was a bad thing, but also it was a bad thing that she died in childbirth and it would have been his fault, according to her. So it's, he wasn't mentioned in a good tone. If ever he was mentioned as a bad man. But I don't think that affected us at all, really. But, you know, because we were quite happy with what we were doing, so it was their problem.
How was the experience of growing up with a twin sister?
We look fairly identical. We are totally different in nature. And well, not totally, of course, not totally, no. But there's a lot of differences. I was always good on the math side and I wasn't bad at English either, but my sister couldn't do maths for nuts. She was terrible. So there were differences, you know, there are differences. She's still alive.
Yeah. And do you see each other very often?
I don't see her very much at all because I can't get around now. I've given my driver's licence up.
Oh.
But my kids go and see her every, or Sally does. She goes and sees her every Wednesday. I don't go on Wednesdays because I go to my tennis club. I don't play now, naturally. But I played till I was 85 and then I tore that bicep tendon and they wouldn't operate. I was too old and they said they couldn't guarantee they could fix it. So 85's not bad. So
that's up. Fantastic.
Yeah, but there's a difference. When Roma used to play tennis and I didn't, she used to play competitive tennis. And I used to just play tennis, hit and giggle, you know, that sort of stuff. Never wanted to be in a team or anything like that, or play matches, you know. But when Roma gave up tennis, she gave me her tennis frock and a racket, and I took up tennis. But not because of that, because my kids, two girls at that stage, were about the 11, 12 age. My husband had played tennis, and they were about to start. I wanted them to play tennis, so because I had to get out with a racket and help them. That was at Happy Valley. That led to me eventually playing. They wanted me to play in the team, and I said, no, I don't want to be tied down, and I'm not a competitive person. Now, my sister is, you know, but I am not. You know. So I said, no, I won't play. But eventually they talked me into it. Because when I took my two girls out, and I had a boy then, so he came out and had a hit, and the two girls came. But then all their friends from Happy Valley came. And in the end, I ended up coaching the Happy Valley Tennis Club's kids, you see, and organising their play. And eventually they said, oh, look, we're short this week, would you play? And I played, and it wasn't that bad. So I thought, oh, well, perhaps I will. So the first thing I said to my kids that I was coaching, OK, do as I say when I'm coaching you. Don't do as I do when I'm playing. But anyway, that was a good thing in a way that I was coaching my kids because I had all these kids, you know, from Happy Valley. Oh, I don't know, must have been 16 or so of them there, boys and girls. And I'd do it after school. And then I'd have to go home and get tea and that. And so, and rather than have people think that I was favouring my own children, which would have been easy to do, you know, I probably was robbing them of a bit of my time, really. So what I did, I went and got my girls. And later on, when the lad got older, coached by a proper coach, you know, so that was that. I paid for them. And then I used to go out there and I'd have to, for them to practice, I'd have to play with them. So I got myself coached as well. And I got to be quite a good tennis player eventually. But I was always, I play better tennis when I'm not playing in a match, you know. And if I'm playing in a hard match, that I've got no hope for. I play good tennis. I don't now, but that's how it was. And I'd go out and they'd say, oh, you're walking in. Well, I'd get so churned up that I didn't say they'd walk all over me. I got scared stiff. I was not a competitor,
So how many years were you actually playing tennis?
Well, I started at 43. That's when I started the tennis bit. And I played for Happy Valley until I was 60-something. And then we came down this way to live, and by that time, you know, my husband wasn't well, so I didn't play, you know. Gave up the coaching bit. Just took up social tennis at the club I'm at now. So 43 to 63 probably it was. And then I played until I was 85, social, you know, until I tore this.
A good 42 years. A good 42 years.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah. So, and I played good tennis when I got playing, when I wasn't being... Well, some of the people down there wanted to win, of course. You weren't allowed to muck around or they'd look down at you. Worry had gone and I could play better tennis.
You could relax.
Yes, more. I relaxed. I didn't get uptight, yeah. And I was in the A team by default. Now, this is a good story. My daughter Sue wasn't all that much into sport because she was short-sighted, right? But eventually she became good with lenses. You know. But anyway, they both played tennis, but Sally was a good player. She was very good. Sue wasn't bad either, but as I said, she had eye troubles, but she wasn't bad. So when, as soon as she turned 16, they put her in the adults team, you know. And I was playing in the B grade and Sally was playing in the A grade. And within a few weeks, she was playing number one in the A grade. So she was good, you know, she was good. One day, she played first double and first single, you know, and then there was a second double and third and fourth single, see, yeah. One day, the girl that played as her partner wasn't there. Rather than bring up the third player in A grade to play second and then bring somebody up from B grade to play last, they didn't want to mess up the second double, you know, the third and fourth. So they said, well, you play with your daughter. Well, we played so damn well. We played for about 4 or 5 years until she went overseas or went up north to teach to start with, that we never got beaten in the doubles.
Really?
Never in all that time. Yeah, all that time playing. And we played Coromandel Valley, Bellevue Heights, Cherry Gardens. I played really well with her, but I used to say to her, now, Sally, if that ball comes to me 4 times in a row, I don't care where it goes, it's yours. She used to play net. I didn't play net, only if I got caught up there, you know. But she used to play net, and she was good at net too. You know, they called her Arcee because she could get anything, you know. So I'd say to her, now, if that ball comes to me 4 times, or I think I did 3, I said, the fourth one is yours, wherever it is, you go and get it, because she could run. I could run too, but I couldn't last too long. You know, 3 hits straight, one after the other's enough for me, I thought. And that's how we played it, and we had a whale of a time. A lovely time. As I said, we never got beaten the whole time we played together. Yeah, so it's good.
What was the name of your club here?
The Happy Valley one.
It was Happy Valley.
Happy Valley, yeah.
Happy Valley Tennis Club?
Yes, that's right. Mm. Actually, after I left there, Leighton Hoop, that's right, he came there afterwards as a kid. Yeah, but I wasn't there. I didn't coach him because I wasn't there. I played hockey on my wedding day.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, well, it worked out that we were going to get married at the end of the hockey season, right? Because I was down here in town, my husband was up in Truro, husband-to-be was up in Truro, and I would play hockey until the end of the hockey season. I'd allow 2 weeks for the semi-finals and finals, if we got into them, right? But we didn't get into them, but we still had the wedding date fixed, so that was all right. We didn't get into them, but unfortunately, we were bottom of the A grade, And so we got challenged, the third week, we got challenged by the top of the B grade on the day that I was supposed to be getting married. So, in the afternoon too, and the matches was in the afternoon. Well, I just said I couldn't let my team down. So I went and played hockey at Port with Rain, and every time the ball came near me, they nearly outmined the bride, you know, and I had a car waiting there for me to take me, not our car, one of the family's cars, you know, and to take me home and have a bath. We didn't have showers in those days. Have a bath and get in my wedding gown and go off. And I didn't tell him what I was doing. I did. But he found out, and when I arrived at the front of there by the altar, he whispered to me, "You dirty little double crosser," in a nice way. I think he was used to me though by that time. So yeah, but I played hockey on my wedding day. Yeah.
And what date was your wedding day?
Wedding day, 12th of September, yeah, 53. My grandmother, to bring us up and bring us down here in Adelaide, and that, of course, we were poor, we're very poor. She had a husband, but he couldn't get a job or something, I can remember that. And we had vouchers, you know, for food and clothes, but she's a very good sewer, so was my aunt. Kept us clothed and fed. They, both my aunt and my grandmother were great gardeners, and when my grandmother was really old, she lived in this house, and the guy next door had a vacant bit of block and that. So Nana not only filled her yard up with veggies, but she filled his up too, because he, you know, she said, "Can I use your, you're not using, can I use it?" She grew flowers and that too. So we had plenty of vegetables and very little meat, but we always had meat, but we had very little. Nan used to send my aunt down to the butcher shop on Thursdays, I can remember this, to buy a shin of beef before he cut the meat off, before the butcher cut the meat off, you know. And what my Nana didn't do with that meat, that bone and that meat and that. And she made stews and casseroles, and then she made soup out the bones. And then she put the bones under the copper, you know, to burn for the copper. And then she took the ashes and put them on the garden. Wonderful, wasn't it?
She's really doing a full cycle there,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, she's been, well, she had to, because we were poor. We were very poor. But she used to make all our clothes. And you hear lots of people who had to do this. The sheets on the bed, when they got worn in the middle, they'd cut them down the middle and turn the sides in where they weren't worn, you know. A lot of people did it though. It was through the Depression. Yeah, so, you know, that was bad. It was bad. But I never felt we missed out on anything, actually, because we were well clothed and well fed. We were old curtains or old dresses that she would cut up and make it into the clothes for us. So, I said, we need funny clothes.
This be the mid-1930s?
When I started school, which was about when I was six, because I was ill before I started, which, and I couldn't go. So my Nana kept my sister back too. But so 26, that'd be 32, right? And that'd be primary then, you know. 32 to 39, I think, was primary. We caught up because we started when we were a year older than most kids, and therefore it wasn't very hard to keep up with them, really. We had that extra year in our head, but not there. So we caught up with the ones that started when they were five.
And what do you remember about your primary school days? Events or funny experiences?
Yeah. Now listen, I was a dreamer. I always used to dream. You know, I'd sit there. And I can remember when I was in grade 7, we had a man teacher, and he was lovely. I liked him, but I still used to dream. I would not be taking any notice, or so he'd think, you know, not any notice. I often got sent out to dream outside. I was a dreamer, and he changed all that for me. You wouldn't have done the old QC, but there used to be, did you know about the old QC, qualifying certificate before you went to high school? Well, we used to have to do a mock QC partway through, nearly at the end, to see how you went. And it was out of 700. And I think I got just over 350. But we were out in the yard, and he was saying to in the group, and he was saying, and I didn't play any sport. My sister did, but I didn't. Eh? And we were out in the yard, and he was going through, and he'd say, and you'll get over 500, and you'll get over 500. And he came to me, and he said, and you'll get over 500 if you just listen. See if you can listen for a while. I was listening, because he must have known that, because sometimes he would ask a question, and I would be one that had the answer, because I was good at maths to start with. So that was, but I didn't know that at the time. But I didn't like the subjects that they taught us, geography and history. Mind you, I belong to a geographic society now. I've learned geography is not like it was there. We had to learn where a place was, why it was important, how many grains of wheat grew, which altered every year. And by the time it was in a book, it was 3 years old anyway. I wouldn't nut that out, but I just hated it. And we had to spout that off before we could go home. You know. And in the end, my teacher always used to say, that's why I liked him so much, oh, for goodness sake, June, get up and go home. But anyway, when he said that to me, I thought, oh, well, perhaps I better listen a bit better and try and stay with it. And I got 606 in that short time. Because, but see, I was taking it in, but not bothering to let it out. You know, that was it. Oh, and I'm still a bit of a dreamer. You know, people often say, where are you off to?
Really?
Yeah, I still dream. Yeah, but I haven't always been as dreamy as that, you know, but I'm getting back to my old, I'm going back to my first, this is my second childhood, so I'm dreaming. So when I went to high school, I never looked back. My sister was way ahead of me, and suddenly, because it was subjects I liked, you know, to start with, I liked maths, and as she hated it, I liked maths, I liked English, although I was all right at that too, but she was better, but... And I just couldn't help it, you know. I liked it, you know. I went ahead. I used to top my class. We used to have a test every fortnight, and where you came in the class, you know, just a test on the fortnight's work. And where you came, and I didn't do any extra work, I might tell you, but it just was came natural then, you know. I listened, in other words. Mm-hmm. And we used to be when the test was over. You got shifted, you know, the top ones in the back row and so on, so on, and I was always in the back row. Oh, it was lovely. I enjoyed it because I was enjoying subjects that I could relate to, yeah. And one of my sons, unfortunately, was the same way. He didn't like learning anything and he didn't want to learn, you know. So, but he, in the end, he got good. I had to talk hard and fast. I sent him to Herbray. Because he was one that never coloured in or did anything like that before he went to school. He was out in the garden, he was out with bits of wood, he was doing all sorts of things like that. Mm-hmm. So I sent him to Herbray, and for the first year they just did a general course, and he didn't do too well at it. But I asked them, would they let him do the agriculture course? Oh, no, we don't. He's a dropout, and I knew he wasn't taking any notice, you know. I said, no, he's a dropout. I said, look, he's a different kid, and I'd like you to recognise that, I said, because he's into all sorts of agriculture and all the rest of it. And anyway, I must have wouldn't take no for an answer, probably. And they let him do the agriculture course, and for the fourth year, he topped the school. So he was. I could recognise that how bad I had been, you know, and he was the same way.
Mm. He had to find his little.
That's right. Something he didn't want to know what happened to sugar when you drap something on it, or how it happened. You know. So he said one to me once, you know. Anyway, but I had none.
It's so important, isn't it, to find and that's identify right. The things in life that you relate to and the
that's
things
right.
that you
he,
love.
And he related, I said, from when you first get outside, he was in the garden and he would have galoshes on, raincoat, no matter what the weather, he'd be out in the garden. And he's still garden mad. Yes. Oh. Yeah.
What was your son's name?
John. We were always going to have a John. And my husband said, what if it's a Sally or a Sue? And I said, oh, it'll never be Sally. I said, it might be Sue. And it was Sue. And the next one was a girl. So Doug said, oh, it's a Sally. I said, oh, no, that's a cow's name. Anyway, he talked me around, and I'm glad he did. You can see how crazy I am.
Oh, this is terrific, June. Like,
we haven't got very far, have we?
Well, that's okay. After high school, what did you move on to after high school?
Well, I went to Teachers College.
Were they good times?
Became social. I went in as a primary teacher to do primary teaching, and because I worked hard that first year, they said, no, you're doing maths and you're doing English and you're doing botany, I think was the science thing that they did. Their secondary schools would put you into secondary. Do you want mine? I said, no, I don't care. So they put me into secondary, but they also made me social secretary. And I didn't do very well that year, so they suggested I go back to primary. And I said, I don't care. And I didn't. I preferred primary, actually. So that was it. So, yeah, but then I ended up eventually in secondary. But most of my... Well, not most of my teaching life, because when I got married, I gave up teaching. My husband didn't want me to work, and I didn't work until I had three. I had Sue and Sally, one on top of the other. And then 5 years down the track, about five, I had John. And then I went, they were all at school, so I used to go and volunteer. Mm-hmm. You know, and I used to go so often that I used to volunteer in the library mostly. But I used to go so often that Doug said one day, oh, look, he said, you spend so much time at that school. He said, you may as well get paid for it. And I said, that's exactly what I've always wanted. So I did. I joined up then, and I was as a relief teacher. Oof. I felt that if they called on you, I was sort of morally bound to fill in the spot, but it wasn't good for me because I couldn't plan my own life, you know. So, some weeks I would work a full week, and some weeks I wouldn't work any days, and you know, you couldn't say right next week I'm going to do this. You could have, but I didn't see. So, in the end, I did a library course. The government put out a library course. Funded a library course for secondary teachers, only secondary schools to advance the libraries or something. So my headmaster said, you're always interested in the library. He said, do that course. So I did the course, and then they wanted me to go full time, and I said, no, I'm not going full time, but I'll go part time, because I had three children by that stage, and I said, I want time with them. So I went part-time, but what happened? I got pregnant again. So that was the end of that. I had George. That was 8 years after John. And then I had another 5 years looking after him. So I was getting a bit off. When I eventually went back teaching, they put me in secondary. So that was in the library. That's where I stayed till I gave up. I was there at Marion High for 15 years.
Most of that was in Marion High School. What other schools?
The biggest school was, the longest school was Marion High, yeah. I was at Seton High for a year, part-time. I only ever went part-time. I often had to go full-time if the boss of the library was away. Or on long service leave, or I always took the spot, and they paid me the boss's fee, my boss that I had, she insisted that they pay me, you know, the right fee, not just as an ordinary teacher. So, I spent a lot of time. In fact, the head said to me one day, oh, you know, now you've had a stint at doing full-time, how about going full-time? And I said, no way, that's not what I want, you know, I'll go part-time. And I went, well, a couple of years I went 4 days a week and some I went 3.5, you know, but I wanted time off to do what I needed to do. Mm. So Douglas?
Think of that.
Ray, R-A-Y. Hanley, yeah. How I met him, well, I was teaching at Angaston at the time, primary, because I was just early 20s, teaching at Angaston, and they couldn't get board over there for the teacher. Couldn't get a teacher from there. And I said, well, I know somebody, the policeman and his wife at Truro, and they're quite prepared to have me. So I bought myself an auto cycle. a bit like the electric bikes you have now, but they weren't electric, you know, you had to pedal them to get them to start. And I used to ride that 9 miles across to Angaston every day. And he lived with he'd come back from the Second World War, and then he'd gone to while I was there, he went to the Korean War, you know, and he was a butcher. And that brother-in-law, and he was the owner of the butcher shop. So he worked for him until he went to Korea. I didn't want to have a bar of him before he went to Korea, because he was a wild boy. He used to drink a lot and that, and I didn't. This will make you laugh, because his sister that he was working with her husband. She wanted him to go out with somebody, what I presume she thought was a nice girl or something. And so she asked me, would I go to this ball with him? So I said, oh, yes, but you know, I wasn't that keen on it, because he had all the girls in the world that he wanted, you know. So but anyway, I went with him. I never saw him all night. He took me there, and the first dance and the last dance, he was outside drinking. See, then that wasn't my type. You know, I didn't do that. Didn't want that. So we didn't sort of... I mean, I was always friendly with him and that, but I wasn't interested in him, if you know what I mean. And it was only when I came down to Adelaide, after I'd been there at Angaston for about 3 years, I think, I came down to Adelaide to teach at, might have been Grange. And he followed me down and took me out, and he came back from the Korean War, and he came back a different boy altogether, you know, absolutely different. To start with, I don't think he could drink, or he did drink still, but it made him ill. He gave it away eventually anyway, but that career, he didn't. The Second World War, he had shrapnel still in him, still coming out when he died, but they went, you know, they fixed him up and they sent him straight back in. But the career, and then after the war ended, he was a wild redhead, I'll tell you, you know. As my nana said, oh, you can't go out with him. He's a redhead. And I said, oh, no, Mum. Now, Mum, I used to call her. I said, I won't marry him. I'll never marry a redhead. And I didn't think I would either. But they were, they're different. So that's it. Anyway. So
he came back from Korea a different person.
Yeah, and different person altogether. Because he said, oh, it was the most terrible place. When the winter, he was only there a little while, and he got invalided out of it, because you couldn't tell the North Koreans from the South Koreans in the day. They'd be going past you, and you'd be behind you, and attack you, and you'd have to dig holes in this iced down ground, you know, and you'd get in their hole one night, and then they'd get in, you'd come back and get in your holes the next, you know. And they were being chased this night, and he was the radio fellow, you know, carried the radio. And they were being chased, and they came to the Han River, And it was a big drop down into the river, and the river was iced over. And I presume because he was tall, he was 6'2", and I assume because he was carrying the heavy equipment, he went through the ice and he got pegged there, you know, straight down off the cliff. Koreans came up and killed off everybody that crossed the river, standing out on the white, you know, but he was through there down by the... And he got out of there, but of course he was never the same again because he was frozen all night, you know, and it affected a lot of his sinuses and things, you know. Mm. So it didn't stop him, though. He came back and he played football, good football. And that caught up with him too in the end, but, you know, the pain of it. I used to say he'd sit in the morning with his legs over the bath, you know, to get his legs going. And then when it was over, the match was over, he'd have to sit over the bath again, you know, with hot and cold, hot and cold. Oh, dear, yeah, but, OK, he played good football, as I said. He was runner-up for the, I think it was called the Male Medal in the country, you know. They have whatever medal they have here for the city lot.
Mm.
He was asked to go down and play for one of the teams, but he had his own butcher shop by then, and of course, and he couldn't get away. So,
whereabouts?
He wouldn't have lasted too long anyway, because his legs wouldn't have stood up to it, you know. But he was runner up for the male medal. That was for the country thing. And Kenny Eustace, you probably don't know him, but he was a youngster at the time, and he won the male medal, you know. But Ken Eustace played football down here for a long time, but anyway, I mean, it didn't worry Doug that he didn't win a medal. He was that sort that didn't care anyway. Mm.
So it's just 45 it ended. Post-war.
But Doug didn't come back to Truro, or even to Australia, until 47, because when he was only 18 when he went over, you know, and they and he went to the Philippines and that area, because the other older ones had been over in Africa and all the rest of it, you know, France. And then when the war came down our way, he was sent to that part. He wasn't ever in the African lot. He wasn't old enough to get there for that. When he was old enough, they'd send him straight to New Guinea. They don't bring the young ones home first. They bring the oldies that have been over in Europe and that, naturally. So he was... So they've got to do something with them. And some of them were sent to Japan as occupational forces. And he was sent to Borneo to work on the war graves, you know, there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because there had been a big prisoner of war camp there in Borneo, in Sandakan. That's on the eastern side of Borneo. Borneo at the top half, you know, it's called Sabah now. And he was sent there because they had a Japanese had a camp there, and it had 3,000, I don't know if it was 3,000 Australians or, yeah, I think it was, there was 3,000 in somewhere, whether it was 3,000 Australians and some English, or whether it was... And only six of them ever came out of that camp alive in the end. Some of them through that period that they were there, the bigwigs, or not bigwigs, you know, but some of the people in charge, whoever they might be, they got sent down further to Kuching, down the south of Borneo, and some got sent elsewhere to get rid of them because they were... high up and therefore knew how to make wirelesses and all things, and they were a problem. So they left just the other guys there. And then towards the end of the war, this is going back before the end of the 45 war, before the end of that war, they could see that they were going to be overtaken by the, you know, our lot. And so they marched them, what was left. A lot of them had died of malaria and goodness knows what else, you know, and being beheaded and cruelly treated and all sorts of things. But they marched what was left, sick as they were, and if they couldn't keep up, they just chopped off their heads or shot them, you know, and pushed them over the mountain a bit. And they, on this track that they took, there was, as I said, there was only six survived. There wasn't the whole 3,000 went on that walk, because a lot of them were dead before they even got to that. But there was only six on that track that escaped. And most of them are dead now, I suppose, too. But anyway, when Doug went there at the end of the war, the six that had escaped were picked up by the Australians, you know, and taken away. But the others that had marched this track and been killed, either there or at Ranelle, where the end of them went eventually, and those that were there, they got killed. A lot of them were killed along that track, and his job was to go with the natives, Dyaks and Dusans, headhunters, you know, and go with them, with a group of them, find the bones, and they were only bones because by this time it didn't take long for the wild animals and the insects and that to spell the bones, pick up the bones if they're in a heap, document if they had still had their teeth, or, you know, if they had a head, because sometimes you couldn't find the head, he said, but, or if they had any previous bones broken, all that sort of thing, and roll them in a blanket, number it, I don't know how they numbered it, but number it, and keep the records of it. And he had to walk from Sandakan to Ranelle, that was the middle of the island, and that's as far as the Japanese got before the help came in, you know, and for the Australians. So that's what he did, you know. And I said to him, how could you do that, Doug? You know, picking these bones up. Oh, and when you got to the end of that lot of territory, say Dyaks, well, the head hunters. From there, their head came down. If you crossed over what was their boundary, but it didn't, you couldn't see a boundary, but, you know, that was, well, they could cut your head off. You know, this cut the, not the Australians, because Doug said they thought he was a god. He was tall, he was redhead, and he had help before he went on up this Labuk River, you know, on that trail, before he went on that. He had dug up some bodies of the natives and that, and also the Chinese that were in the towns, and had them reburied because the Japanese were just, you know, wouldn't do that. They just throw them in a heap and cover them up, and he had to dig that, and he did all that. You know, I mean, he was that sort of guy, and he got on well with the natives. At one stage, he said he got sleeping sickness or something, and they only ate what they ate. They cooked. They took chooks with them in their little boats. the things that they wrapped up, they would put on the river, and then when they came down the river, when the real floods came, they were in water all the time. But down, they made rafts, and they would pick them up and put them on the rafts. A really interesting life. So when he came back to Australia, of course, he couldn't settle. That's why he joined the Korean. But how they let him, I don't know. He must have been pretty sly or something, or just in good health at the time, because he had terrible malaria when I married him, and he had it, you know, when he came back from Borneo. So. But he must have somehow or other hidden that fact and got himself to Korea. But he didn't like Korea. He said it was the arse end of the world. When it got frozen, he said everything froze, you know. He said, it was terrible. And Sally went there, that daughter, you know, she went there to teach English. And she was also, she wanted to go to Borneo. She wanted to go to Brunei. Rich country, you know, and they looked after you well, no taxes, everything like that. and she had to get her master's. As long as she got MA after a name, she said it wouldn't have mattered if it was in underwater knitting, Mum, she said. Mm-hmm. But anyway, she got it for the language part of it. She went over there and she did her master's there. She arranged with the uni, which was difficult, wasn't the days of computers or anything, you know.
Mm.
But Sue, her sister, was here in Adelaide, and she used to send the work to her sister and she would take it into the uni. Once she got her master's, she left there and she was very glad to do it because winter had come in and all the pipes had cracked and frozen and the rats came in. She said, I can see why Dad said it was the arse end of the world, Mum, you know. So she came home and applied to go to Borneo, Brunei, and she got it. Mm. So, and she had a house provided and worked half a day. Mm-hmm. You know, they worked from 8 till 12 or half past 12 or something, anyway. Mm-hmm. And played tennis the rest of the time and other things. It started a choir with the girls that were there, because there are a lot of people there because they're all there for the oil, you know. Mm. There were Dutch and people from all over the world there. She had a good time there. And now she still keeps in touch with them. They go and visit one another every now and again. But, of course, not in the last couple of years. But she came home. She eventually went to Hong Kong, but she was mostly in Brunei. She left here when they brought in a system where if you were 10 years at a school, you had to move on and you had to move out in the country. Well, that didn't worry Sally because she started in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But then when she came back to town and that, she'd already done 10 years in town, and so she was a permanent teacher, but they didn't give you a permanent school, and so you would be 10 weeks here, 10 weeks there. And Sally was the sort of person, she wasn't married, she wasn't looking to get married, she played too much sport, she used to play hockey, she played basketball, netball, and tennis. I mean, she's a real sport, you know. And so she didn't like it, and she was into music. Wherever she went, she started up a choir in the school. She started one over at Kangaroo Island, and the parents couldn't believe that their boys, there was only thing in Kangaroo Island to amuse them was the girls had basketball and the boys had football and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she started up this choir in Adelaide here, a choir in the schools. Every year they would have concerts in the festival theatre. You remember them? Well, she was part of that system.
Okay.
Yeah, she was part of that. And when she went over to Kangaroo Island, there was none of that, of course, you know. So she decided she would start it. So she asked the guy, whoever he was, she knew him. She said, right, I want to start a choir, she said, but I want to start a choir that's going to be successful and you're going to accept them, because they won't be able to come over here and practice, you know, from Kangaroo on to here. It wouldn't be possible for them, you know, mm-hmm. she said. And he said, well, you know the standard I want, Sally. He said, go for it. And she got a team up. She got the boys interested. And the parents couldn't believe it. And some of the boys, she said, had beautiful voices, you know, because they were only kids, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And she got this choir going and brought them over here, you know, over mm-hmm. here to Adelaide. And they had their night at the Adelaide Festival.
Wonderful.
It was the beginning of something. And she got them into all sorts of other competitions, Australia-wide, actually. There was one in Queensland, I forget what that was for. And she didn't go. I don't think she went with them because she stayed behind and minded that's right, because she could only send so many and give them special lessons, she had to.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the rest of the class wanted the special lessons too, so she used to do that as well. You know, she would give them that. And so she stayed behind with the people that weren't that fortunate. And I think one of the mothers went with her, or a couple of the mothers went with the kids to Queensland.
You mentioned your wedding day and that you played hockey on your wedding day.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't play anything after that because, no. You know, there wasn't in the country. They didn't have a hockey team in the country. Mm, so that was it. I think at one stage I coached their basketball, But don't put that down, because that was only very briefly, because then I was pregnant and I didn't. But one of the girls from there, I haven't been in touch with her for a while, but that's my fault. But she was my neighbour. She was only a girl, you know, and I was married. And she used to help me look after Sue, my first child, you know. But she reminded me, I didn't remember this, she said, "You coached us for basketball 1 year and we won." And she said, "It was the only year we won." And I said, did we win?" I didn't even know that they won. Well, I hadn't remembered. But, you know, there you are. Yeah. So, okay, keep going.
Okay.
I tell you what, I have been busy in all those years, particularly since my husband died, because I thought, well, now I'm not going to sit home like a lot of widows. I know. And don't go anywhere, don't do anything. So I said no to nothing. You know, I said, I'm going to say no to nothing. It means I joined the Legacy Club at Chrissy's Beach, and we used to have, and I was president of that for quite a few years, president, secretary, because you're only allowed to be president for 3 years, so the president and I, secretary and I used to do. And a carload used to come over from Angaston, with some war widows, with some legacy ladies, and they came, she came over there, and if she didn't come, well, they couldn't come, you know. And they also used to bring handicraft that the hospital people made. So I said to them one day, "How many people you got over there that are legacy?" And said, "Oh, we've got quite a few." So because I was president, I was the one to go and approach headquarters in town, said, "How do I go about starting a club?" And I did. I started that club, you know. And that was, it's been stopped now for about 3 years, I suppose, but it went for 26 or something years, you know. So it was necessary, you know, because there were a lot of widows over there.
Need, yes.
But being connected with legacy, and not just being a member, you know, being a bit more than that, they said to me that I was eligible to be a war widow because my husband was made a TPI 10 days before he died. He just got it and he died. You know, he had to fight them, but even though he was invalided out of the war and the rest of it, he came home on an American hospital ship and all the rest of it. Some people didn't think he should get it. Anyway, he got it. I used to say to him, "Why do you worry about it? You go into these tribunals." And I used to go take him in because he couldn't drive in. And I'd go in with him. And, one day I was so busy trying to find all sorts of things to blame, you know, for his illnesses and all the rest of it. And he had them. And I just got angry with him and said, "I'm not going to sit in here and listen to you rubbish my husband." I said, I went out. Outside. They asked me to go, that's right, they asked me to go. And that's right. And then the next time when I went in with him, I was sitting out, I didn't go in, and they came out to get me and said, "Oh, would you come in?" And I said, "I'm not coming in there to listen to you rubbish my husband." I said, "None of you guys have been to the war, and you're all in judgment, you know, of what effect it has on you." Anyway, they said, "Oh, come in and we'll be better." And they were, you know. But anyway, he did get it, but he only got it 10 days before he died. And I used to say to him, "Oh, why do you worry, Doug? You know, why are you worrying about it?" And he said, "Because you will be taken care of. You know, if I die, we had 10 acres over here at Maslin's Beach. Not subdivisional or anything, just 10 acres with one house only on it. That's all you could put on it. And when they assess you, they assess you as that being... house blocks. I mean, even though it wasn't mm-hmm. allowed to be house blocks.
Wasn't
and therefore,
yeah.
Doug used to get a small pension, 100%, but it was small, I tell you. And I used to get a pension, a little bit, that was smaller still, about $4 or something, I think. But I also had a bit of super. I'd put myself into super when I was working, you mm-hmm. know, and... So we decided, right, that he decided that if anything happened to him, I wouldn't be getting his pension, or I might get a small pension, but I'd have to go the way of the thing. I couldn't get an old age pension, because of the land I had, I'd have to sell it, which I didn't want to. So when he got this gold card, well, then he was happy. And I think he just sort of, he was ill, mind you, he was really ill. But I think he just hung on just to say that he got it. And 10 days later, he died. That was it. Dropped dead. But anyway, that's the way of it. So, and I stayed there for just over 20 years and got a war widow's pension. I didn't have to worry about the old age pension. The war widow's pension was mine. They couldn't take it, and it isn't they can't tax you on it. And not only that, all my medical is taken care of. And that's your biggest worry, isn't it? When you're sort of getting on, you've got to always keep some behind in case you get ill. I don't have to, because I'm taken care of, you know. So it was really a wonderful thing to get. But I wasn't aware of that, because I wasn't in the war or anything. So I knew nothing about that, but he did. He had his head screwed on right. Yeah, that was it.
Was looking out for you.
And that's when the legacy said, look, you could belong to the guild. It didn't have anything to do with my pay. I was still getting the pension, but I joined the guild and was on it for a few years, and then somebody said go on the committee, and then someone said do this, do that, and I ended up as president for 3 years. That was our limit, you know. Yeah, and now I'm just on the committee, but I've just been re-elected again. But I said, look, this is the last year I'll give you, because we're getting a nice lot of younger people in now, and they're wonderful, you know. So that's it. You can do things that I could never do, you know. So, but I did do something, and I'm very pleased that I did for the war widows while I was president. When I became president, they kept saying, saying to me, because I was a sort of a new hand, I hadn't been there very long, I didn't know much about the war widows, I certainly didn't know anything about the Department of Veterans Affairs or anything. I didn't move in those circles. Mm-hmm. I don't move in the hoi polloi, you know, so that was it. They said to me, oh, look, we've got to try and work out something that's going to happen, because we had 38 units in two different places, one on Fullerton Road, just opposite the racecourse. They've got a complex there, and they had, I don't know how many now, units. And then up that side road, they had another lot of units, right? And they said, what are we going to do? Because a lot of the people were getting a bit, this is near to about 2000, early 2000. And some of them were finding it hard to get, because we ran everything. We collected the rents, and we roofed the roof, and everything that went wrong, we had to run it. And I could see that when I was president, sometimes at one stage I was busy explaining something to somebody, and they asked the most ridiculous question or said something, and I said, oh, for goodness sake, get your brain into gear. It didn't go down too well. I'd been talking there, telling them, and they were a lot like that. They waited till people put up there. We had 14 on the committee, and I suppose about five of them were losing it, so that was I'm losing it now, so I'm glad I'm not going to be on it now. But they said, well, we've got to do something. So I approached Laurie Lewis, who was brigadier or somebody. First of all, I approached the head of the War Widows Guild over in the New South Wales, I think she was, anyway. I said, who do I approach to do something about this? And she put me on to Laurie Lewis and another guy who was somebody, Healy. There was a president at the time who was a June Healy. They often used to get us mixed up, June Healy and June Haley. But he was good too, but he died shortly after cancer of some sort. And so we were left with Laurie, but Laurie was good, and he called a meeting, a nice meeting in the Army, Navy, and Air Force headquarters, nice afternoon tea and that, and said, now the way you've got to go now is use your equity and do something, approach social groups. So I did that, and there was ECH and ACH and somebody Brown and quite a few of them, but the only group would allow us to stay there in those quarters was ACH, right, Aged Care and Housing. They were the only ones that would would do it, but they would take over. We would donate the place to them. This is what was really hard to sell. Don't give them $4 million worth of stuff, because that's what it was at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
And on condition that they, refurbish all our units, because they were all old. They all had stoves on the floor, and they weren't cooking because they couldn't get down to it. And
so
we decided that we might go along with them, and it took us 2 years, took me 2 years arguing with my own group to get them to go along with it, because they wanted to sign up straight away. To start with, they thought they were going to continue to keep the rents. I mean, how silly can you be? The ACH are taking over and they're doing all the re-roofing, all the running of the place. We had to let them have the rent. There was no way that they were going to do that. So our lot hadn't worked it out. But anyway, I said, right, well, now we've got somebody interested and we'll do what we want to do. We'll refurbish the places and all the rest of it. I said, and give us a contract. Let's do it. But it took me 2 years arguing with them because they did not care. They didn't want things in writing. They'd say, oh, it'll be negotiated. We negotiated that we get air conditioners either outside, and you have to set the thing on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, lots and lots of things. And they're all run down and everything. And so I fought them for 2 years and I wasn't president at the end of that. Before that, I was just getting to the end of the being president when we signed up. And I said, now I'm going to go devil's advocate and I'm going to fight for everything because I feel responsible for what I've done. We're doing there. They were happy to sign up. In fact, if they didn't put it in writing and didn't put in writing what I wanted, like wall ovens to start with and stove tops on your bench, with special sort of set up so you couldn't leave them on, all that sort of thing. Oh, it must have been hundreds and hundreds of things because I kept...
It sounds very exhausting.
Well, it wasn't exhausting, but I was really in a fight, I'll tell you, because they wanted to sign up, and I'd say, look, I'm only one, take a vote on it if you really want to, but they weren't going to take a vote on it. They weren't. Mm. And at one stage, my... half-brother, that's got the second family my father had. I eventually caught up with him, by the way, when I was 30. He died, right. And I went up to Broken Hill. Either he was dying or he died. I went up both times anyway. And when I came back, they said, oh, we've passed it. We're going to, sign up with the things. I said, well, great. I said, why did you wait till I wasn't here? I said, that wasn't fair. That's not right, is it? If they took a vote, they didn't take a vote on it while I was there. They wouldn't vote, against me. I mean, not that I was ordering them to. I said, I used to say to them, look, I'm one against you. If you're not game to put your name down and vote for it and leave me out, and while I'm here, I said, I don't appreciate you doing it when I wasn't here. And they saw the reasoning in that. I mean, it was fair, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't, and it took us 2 years.
Wow.
2 years to get through, but they have been marvellous to us. They have, the guy that was there, the guy that used to come and argue with me, he wasn't the head of the thing, but I didn't like him. He came along with things written in the new constitution. We went from 38 units down once to 34. I said, where'd the other four go? And we weren't supposed to notice that, and they didn't. I did, but they didn't, That's the mass part of it, see?
You spot that, yeah.
Yeah, and anyway, but we were very, very happy now, and they do look after us. And our contract was going to go for 13 years, where they had to let war widows come in, at no cost. There's no cost to come into those units, no cost. And they look after them and upgrade all the units. They never did get to finish upgrading all the units before the 13 was out, but it didn't matter because the upstairs ones we couldn't use because they couldn't get up to them.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. But anyway, so I decided I'd put it on the market. And the guy across the road got to hear of it, and he came to see me. He's Santik his name. You know, it's a different nationality. He came and he said, "I believe you're going to sell your house." And I said, "Yeah, you don't know anybody rich, do you?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm rich." And I said, "Oh, well, you're just the one then." And he said, "How much do you want for it?" Now, this will make you laugh. I had it priced, you know, and I'd had a family trying to get it from me for years, you know, wanting me to buy it, and they'd let me live there because you know how that would work out. It wouldn't have worked out at all. And then I was going to go into a retirement village, and they wanted to buy it, you know, there and then. Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, I'm not until I'm ready to go." I wouldn't even let them come and assess the place, the retirement village, because I said, "What's the point? You know, that's it." Anyway, when we built it, Doug said, "No, we won't have a little house, Jim. We won't have a big one, but we'll have a reasonable size one." So I went along with that, and I said, "Why is that, Doug?" He said, "Because one day this place will be worth about a million." So when the guy said, "How much do you want?" I'd already had the agents in, and they were going between 800,000 and 900,000. So I just said, "$1 million." He said, "How much do you want?" I said, "Oh, $1 million. He said, "What, not a penny more or a penny less?" I said, "No, $1 million, I'll be happy with that." And he paid it. Really? I never even got an agent in. Yeah. Right. So I bought this small place, and I'm right. I was living the way I wanted to live. I didn't need any more money, you know. So that's it.
Wow.
Yeah. Very happy.
That's lovely.
And, you know, I enjoyed doing it because I could see my inheritance, what they were doing with it, because they all had mortgages, you know. So that's it. But how lucky can you be?
Oh, well, that's, you know, you put it to good use. And
so that was it. But it was so funny the way it came about, though.
Just coming across the road.
You don't know anybody rich. You don't know anybody rich, do you?
You're now at the age of 94 years. Mm. From your life experiences, what advice would you give the young generations of today?
I don't know. Stay happy if you can. I say to my kids, you know, whatever happens, search for the positive in it. If something happens that's bad, find something good in it. You might have to search for something ridiculous, but, you know, find something good in what happens to you. Because having my husband die was really negative, you know. But as I said, I got out, as the kids said, "Mum, Dad would have wanted you to get out and get on with your life." And I said, "Oh, well, that's what I'll try." And I joined everything, as I said.
You're very active.
Yes, I am. And I think that's what keeps me going. And as I said, I've enjoyed it. And did I tell you that this year they gave me an OIM?
No, you didn't mention that.
Oh, well, I did.
Congratulations.
They gave me they give you a thing, you know, here, which I probably will never wear. And then they had two little ones, which I would wear. And I thought, two. I thought, who wants two? I might get a maiden earrings. And I thought, no, I don't wear earrings very often, so I won't. So I had one of them made into a ring here. Yeah, I had it made into a ring because I wouldn't wear it as a... I don't know that I'll ever wear the big thing because I don't, you know, I'm not that sort of person, you know. But anyway, so I had that made into a ring. So it's very nice, isn't it? I've only just got it back from the jeweller.
That is, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Jean, I'd like to say thank you so much for allowing me into your home and for sharing.
Oh, you haven't had to say in anything, though.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for sharing some stories with me. Mm-hmm. You're an amazing lady, and 94 years of age, you look fantastic.
Well, that's kept me young. As I said, I was very... little Selma, you know, at the club... She wanted to put my name down, and she said, you know, I said, no, you can't do that. I said, I've done because I wanted to. I've started a lot of things, I said, because I wanted to. I mean, joined Dan put my name down, and she said, oh, please, please. So I thought, oh, well, I won't get it. So I said, all right, put it down. So she put it down. And so the day that they came out in the paper, I was so sure that I wouldn't get it. I wasn't even interested. I got brought the paper in and never even read it. Somebody rang me up and said I was in the paper and I'd got to know who I am. I really honestly didn't think I deserved it because I had so much fun doing what I did. You know, it was never a chore, you know, so there you go. But I did start a lot of clubs and supported a lot of things, you know. So I suppose that's what they worked on. It wasn't just the war widows, it was other things that I'd done for other groups.
So many. Yeah.
In other words, I think I'm probably a bit of a leader. You know, that would be it, wouldn't it? Really? Or bossy.
To be continued.
To be continued. Right.
Okay. Jean, thank you so much.
Okay, so do you want some help in there?
If you or someone you know would like to be captured in a podcast, contact Christian Teusner via this email address, theemutree@gmail.com. theemutree@gmail.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.